Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How you doing, Frank? It's been a while since we've had a chance to do one of these.
It's been a while, David. You know, we keep promising we're going to continue this thing, and I think we do want to continue it. We want to continue it, and we've received some positive feedback from listeners, but we have to come up with a better routine, but that's for us to sort out.
Yeah, I think we both have been traveling a lot recently, and the time zones haven't helped, and
yeah,
in the future, time zones won't help either, but yeah, so be it.
Hopefully we'll sort it out, people. So we feel guilty, if that's any consolation, dear listeners. David, I encountered a listener recently.
In the wild.
I'd like to, in the wild, in Owensboro, Kentucky, in fact, where I was honored to give the Wade Lecture, Kentucky Wesleyan College. But I had the great pleasure of spending some time with a listener there, James, who likes the podcast. So I wanted to say hello to him and to thank him and all our listeners for tuning in. The other thing I would say is I was doing a book event up at Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, recently, and I met a listener there whose name I didn't get. He was in line to get his book signed. So thank you, listeners.
Oh, well, that's great to find that we have listeners all over the place, or at least in the greater Virginia, Kentucky region of the world.
The other thing I'd like to say, David, if I could turn this into a travel log, if you ever have the opportunity to go to Owensboro, Kentucky, do so. Take it. It's a beautiful little town. It's right on the Ohio River, and it is the home to the Bluegrass Music Museum and Hall of Fame, which is well worth your time. So okay. Owensboro, Kentucky, I can recommend it. I had barbecue and bourbon, as one is expected to do in Kentucky.
I was going to ask about that. Okay, good.
And can endorse both.
Okay. Sounds good. Sounds good. Right. So earlier this week, the primary elections have resulted in what I think everyone has been expecting for many months, and that is that both President Biden and former President Trump have cinched the nominations of their parties, and will then be having a rematch election in November. And so today we're going to talk about rematch presidential elections, of which there have been six previous presidential rematches, and this, I guess, will be the seventh. For those of you who aren't immediately recalling this at home, those are in 1800, 1828, 1840, 1892, 1900, and 1956. Today we're going to try to sort of make sense of what, if anything, we can learn from these previous rematches and what it might tell us about the one we're about to live through, for better or for worse.
So, David, before we do that, how do you feel about this rematch? Are you excited? I will say that having traveled across a large swathe of these United States in the past week, I'm not detecting a huge amount of enthusiasm for this rematch, but I'm wondering what you think from your corner of the world.
Yeah, I'm sensing a similar kind of apathy. I think there are lots of people in both parties who would prefer they had somebody else to choose from, but when given the choices of other people to choose from in the primaries, they seemingly didn't do that. I think we'll see some antecedents in that in the elections we're going to look at, that sometimes rematches lead to enhanced excitement about the election, but sometimes it's people are kind of bored with candidates they're already familiar with and the choices they've already made once before. I'm not seeing a whole lot of enthusiasm either for Biden nor for Trump beyond their sort of core constituencies. And it's hard to figure out what that means then in terms of how one campaigns when the voters already know who you are and what you stand for.
Yeah, and it's a slightly, I mean, it's the first time in 68 years, I think, we've had one of these. So we don't have a huge frame of reference, and certainly nothing terribly recent. But this is a strange one because, as you say, both candidates are very well known to the electorate, which doesn't seem to benefit either of them. And there's a weird sense around this one, again, which is unusual, at least for us in our lifetimes, because both men can run kind of as incumbents. I mean, Biden is the incumbent, but Trump very much feels like, and he's running as an incumbent candidate as well, in part because he's refused to accept the result of the last election.
Yes.
But it's not just that. So incumbency confers a certain benefit upon candidates, but I wonder if that's mitigated a little bit in this particular case, because both kind of have the benefit of
Yeah.
incumbency to a certain extent.
Yeah, they both have
But
demonstrated to at least their voters that they can do the job, or at least have sat in the desk. And so thinking about the sort of how, as you point out, we haven't had one of these recently, but there actually have been a lot of these kinds of
yes.
rematch elections, right? So if you think about in the 19th century, these seem to be, fairly regular events, and especially when you consider that we've had, four presidents assassinated and a couple other die in office of natural causes, and only a, not that many elections really when you think about it. The rematch phenomenon was very, very common, relatively speaking, in the 19th century, and not so much in the 20th. And but yeah, let's go back to the first one, since that's one I think you've written about pretty extensively and know pretty well, and that's the election of 1800, which is a rematch of 1796. So this is
Yeah, which
John Adams versus Thomas Jefferson, round two.
never heard of them. This is a presidential election that pitted a member of the American Philosophical Society against a member of what became the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. So
Oh, sure. It's a really an academic powerhouse there. Okay, good.
yeah, Jefferson, of course, ran for president in 1796 in what's generally reckoned to be the first contested presidential election, because the first two had been won by George Washington, and they were largely uncontested. Well, they were uncontested. And so the first contested presidential election was the third one, which saw Adams, the vice president, run against Jefferson of Virginia, the former Secretary of State. And Adams won that, and so it was a third straight election for the Federalists. Prior to the adoption of the 12th Amendment, whoever came second in the Electoral College was required to serve as the vice president. And so Jefferson served as Adams's vice president from 1797 until 1801. And the two men ran against each other again in the presidential election of 1800. That was a bitterly contested election, largely because of the kind of rise of partisanship during the 1790s, particularly in the aftermath of the Alien and Sedition Acts and the debate around those and the constitutional and political crisis that they engendered. The election of 1800 was a bit of a mess. The first time, that an election would be decided in the House of Representatives, because there was no clear winner in the Electoral College. However, Jefferson beat Adams in the Electoral College, but he tied with his notional running mate, Aaron Burr. This will be familiar to people who've seen or listened to Hamilton.
Now on stage in Edinburgh, for those of
I
you who are
know,
listening
I
locally.
know. Basically, that election was thrown to the outgoing Federalist-dominated House of Representatives, which, after 36 ballots in February of 1801, selected Jefferson to be the president. And Jefferson was inaugurated in March of 1801. And famously, John Adams, his once close friend and future close friend, refused to attend the inauguration and left before Jefferson was sworn in. So it was pretty bitter, but it was largely bitter because of the kind of drama and competition it inspired within the two nascent political parties. So one of the things that cost Adams that election, it's historians reckon, and I think with justification, was that Alexander Hamilton had attacked Adams and said he was insane in the run-up to the election. And Hamilton was in the same party, the Federalist Party, as Adams. Meanwhile, Jefferson and Burr were circling each other like two dogs that want to fight that don't really trust each other. And so there was a great deal of kind of Sturm und Drang around that election, but it was largely intra-party, although Jefferson and Adams were estranged as a result of this election, although that was really the coup de grace of their estrangement, I think, and didn't speak for 11 years before and until their correspondence started, they restarted their correspondence during their retirement.
Well, one of the things that your description of this makes me think of, and maybe sort of looking forward to these other elections, I think we'll find a similar theme there, is how personal rematches are. They tend to be much more about sort of the personality flaws of the various candidates and very bitter sort of mudslinging than it is about issues. Per se, I think that in terms of the narratives of the elections, I don't know whether you think that's.
Yeah, I think that's right, David. I think that is true. In most of these cases, we see bitterness. Running for president is an intense activity. For a politician, an American politician, it's the ultimate achievement. To lose has got to be embarrassing and humiliating at some level for these people who have large egos. And thus, I think the desire for revenge in a rematch, and I use revenge deliberately, is probably pretty strong. These are people who have very strong personalities and big egos, and I think we see this as early as this first rematch in 1800. Having said that, I'm not quite sure. I don't think there, I mean, apart from the human drama of it and the fact that I'm interested in this period, that the election of 1800 offers us much insight into the election of 2024. I think some of the subsequent ones we might discuss might have more to tell us about those, but it is interesting in terms of setting that precedent. You're right, and the importance of personality. I suspect that whoever is inaugurating January of 2025, the loser, if it's one of the two candidates we think it will be, is unlikely to maintain much contact with the winner after that
Yeah, there's
after
not
that
going to be the friendly
inauguration.
note that George Herbert Walker Bush left and for Clinton or whatever it is.
No, that's right. That's right. So I think personalities do matter.
Right. So the next one of these is in 1828, and we've got another Adams in this election. There's some family drama in these, I think, that runs through them for reasons that are coincidence entirely, but are kind of fun. So we've got both Adamses here, and 1828 is John Quincy Adams running against Andrew Jackson for the second time. And we've talked about this election a lot in previous episodes because I think this is both this one and the previous one. But do you want to give the Cliff Notes version, or shall I do that?
Sure. I can do that because I suspect we're going to be starting to rely quite heavily on you for subsequent
Oh,
ones, David.
okay.
Although I think you that we share to the extent we have expertise in Jackson, I think we share it,
Yes,
right?
we
So
have.
you may want to fill in some of the blanks for me. So John Quincy Adams, one thing to say when you talk about personalities, look, the Adamses brought many virtues and strengths to their political careers and contributed much to the history of the United States. They were both pretty thin-skinned. And that will play a role in this. So John Quincy Adams had run against Andrew Jackson in 1824. And the 1824 election is very, very confusing and confused. And we've talked about this in the past. Basically, there were four main candidates in 1824. And Adams lost both the popular vote and the vote in the Electoral College the first time around to Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson, however, did not have a clear majority in either the popular vote or the Electoral College. So this election, too, was decided by the House of Representatives. One can only imagine how the Adams family, father and son, felt about the Electoral College after this. Though they would have had mixed views, I suppose, because in 1824, the House of Representatives chose John Quincy Adams to be president. Now, what it did was completely above board and legal, even if it seemed to smell a little, it smelled a little funny if you were a Jacksonian Democrat, because you see, Jackson had a majority in both the House, in both the popular vote, and, all of which doesn't matter, and the Electoral College, but not a plurality, or not, he had a plurality, but not a majority. And so, in the 1828 rematch,
Oh, should we talk
this
about the
was,
corrupt bargain? We should probably mention
yes.
that. Yeah.
Yeah,
So
go ahead. Talk about the
one of the
corrupt bargain,
candidates
please.
that didn't win was Henry Clay. Henry Clay told his supporters to vote for John Quincy Adams, which they did, and hence Quincy Adams wins in this thing it does in the House or in Congress when they decide who's going to actually take office. And then subsequently, Clay gets named Secretary of State. So there's this sort of what appears to be a quid pro quo to get Adams in the White House. So
That's
they
right.
think it's an
And to,
election that's stolen from them.
that's right. And to some extent, Henry Clay plays the role of Alexander Hamilton from 1800, where Hamilton had more or less was the kingmaker and, indicated to the House of Representatives that they should go for Jefferson rather than Burr. And Clay plays a similar role. The crucial difference in 1828 is, or 1824 rather, is that Clay seemed to benefit from that advice in that he was made Secretary of State. And so that is going to engender a huge amount of animosity on behalf of Andrew Jackson, a man who liked to hold a grudge, and
Yes,
his
that should put it
supporters.
mildly. Yes.
And, the corrupt bargain and the fact that the election was stolen from them is essentially what Jackson will run on in 1828. The country is democratizing in the sense that the franchise is spreading at least among white men, and Jackson will benefit from that, and he wins pretty handily in 1828. So he
Yeah.
wins the rematch. What's interesting about these first several rematch elections is the loser of the first election is winning the second time round, and we'll see this in the next couple as well. That doesn't happen later, or it hasn't happened in the later election. So
Yeah.
I don't know whether that pattern is significant or not, but in these first two, the loser of the first election comes back
Yeah.
and wins. What's interesting, and I think this is something we might consider when we think about some of the later elections and why this hasn't happened as frequently in the recent past, is losers get a second chance. They're getting a second bite of the cherry, at least in the 19th century and the early 20th century. That becomes less common later. Is there anything else to add about
Well,
1828?
just I mean, I think there's a couple things that are I think worth noting. That's different between that happens in the interval between the two elections. One, as you point out, there are a lot more voters. Simply, the number of people who vote in 28 is a lot bigger than voted in 24. Jackson's really able to take advantage of the media. There's a whole sort of new newspaper landscape that he's really able to sort of leverage. And that in 28, they're not really talking about issues. They are really sort of slinging mud at each other. The mud that's slung at Jackson is that Jackson is a murderer who likes to get into duels, which is mostly true, and that he was a bigamist, which may or may not be true. The mud that was slung at Adams was that he had procured a young girl as a prostitute for Emperor Alexander I when he was minister of Russia, and
He
that he
was
had
the
a
pimp for the Tsar of Russia.
Sure. And that he had a billiard table in the White House and that he made the American people pay for it, which he did have a billiard table. No, he didn't make the American people pay for it. But it's very much these sort of personal failing kinds of attacks rather than debates over the tariff or other kinds of equally exciting issues. Right. The third of these, which I think is probably less well known than the first two we've talked about, is in 1840. That is Martin Van Buren versus William Henry Harrison, a matchup for the ages. So the background to this one is the previous election where Martin Van Buren, who was Andrew Jackson's successor, sort of named su successor, inheritor, if you will. He runs in 1836. He defeats actually several Whig candidates. The Whig Party was brand new at that point and was still getting its act together. They had actually run several candidates in 1836 against Martin Van Buren, including William Henry Harrison, but Van Buren wins that one. What happens in the interval between those two elections that really shape things? There's an economic panic in 1837 that really damages Van Buren. There are a whole lot of newspaper attacks again in the lead up to 1840. There are accusations that William Henry Harrison was an alcoholic, which actually Harrison used to his advantage. The he was accused of somebody, the accusation made against him was that he would sit all day in a log cabin drinking hard cider, and that became actually a selling point for him. He actually sold things of cider and whiskey out of barrel a bottle shaped like log cabins. Harrison's able to defeat Van Buren in 1840, mostly over economic issues, but also over these other things. One of the issues, though, in the election was Harrison's age. Harrison was the oldest man to be elected president at the age of 68, which
Spring
was,
chicken.
well, they said, like, look, this man's too old to be president. Turns out, his presidency didn't last very long, in part because he was 68, in part because he didn't wear a hat when he gave his inaugural address, and it was 2 hours long in the cold weather in March in Washington, D.C., and shortest presidency out there. So, so much for
32 days, even lo it's even shorter than Liz Truss's
that.
premiership.
Okay, so it's an and yeah, so you gave us the William Henry Harrison. There it is.
So, are there any lessons to be drawn from this one? I guess, David, the question we have to ask ourselves, and we need to keep going, I realize, is are there lessons to be drawn, or are these just coincidences?
I think if we look at all six of them, there are some lessons to be drawn.
Okay,
I
so
think not
let's.
necessarily from each individual one. I think I think age is going to come up in actually a couple more of these because one of the things about rematches is that everyone who is running has run before, which means they're definitely getting up there in age. The next on the list, though, I guess number one, two, three, four. We're halfway through, more than halfway through. 1892. This is the weird one. This is Grover Cleveland versus Benjamin Harrison. And as
So we
you
have
point
another
out,
family connection here.
yes, we got both Harrisons showing up. So we have all the Harrisons. We've got all the Adamses and all the Harrisons. Take that for what you will.
So David, just sorry, David, before you, I can see you're gearing up to tell us
Yes,
about this,
this
but
is an exciting look.
what is the relationship between Benjamin Harrison and William Henry Harrison?
Benjamin Harrison is William Henry Harrison's grandson.
Okay, just
That
to keep everybody on. Yep, go ahead now. Tell
we've
us about it.
got the genealogy all going through. Right, so this is an interesting one in some ways, the one that's some people have said most similar to the one we're in now, because both, so Benjamin Harrison is the sitting president in this election. Grover Cleveland had been president, but had lost to Benjamin Harrison the previous election and is now running again. Just so people understand sort of the context here, in the previous election in 1888, Cleveland had won the popular vote, but Harrison had won the Electoral College. This was relatively common in the late 19th century, including this election. And when they leave, Cleveland is pretty sure he wants to come back. In fact, Cleveland's wife supposedly told the people in the White House to take good care of the furniture because they're going to be back there in 4 years. This is an interesting election in 92 because I don't think actually anybody running was deeply enthusiastic about either of these candidates, or in fact, the candidates weren't even all that enthusiastic about running. Benjamin Harrison's a Republican. His wife is very sick at this point, and he wants to not run for president. He wants to take care of her. Unfortunately, though, for him, his big rival in the Republican Party, he doesn't want him to be president. That's James G. Blaine of the state of Maine, sometimes known as the Continental Liar of the state of Maine. He's sort of the main rival within the Republican Party. He knows if he doesn't run, Blaine's going to run, and he doesn't want Blaine to be president. So he decides, Blaine, by the way, also doesn't want to be president because he actually has some health issues, so he doesn't really want to be president. So Harrison is running, but doesn't really want to run. Cleveland does want to be president again, but it seems as if the enthusiasm for both parties in this election is really, really low.
Why?
I think part of it is the They've seen both Cleveland and Harrison, and I think there's a large segment of the population that doesn't like either of them. This is an election where you do see the rise of a third party, the People's Party or the populists, as a meaningful third alternative, and they do very well in 1892, in part because the two major parties don't really speak to them. I found this very interesting sort of postmortem after the 1892 election by James D. G. Blaine that he published literally like a couple of weeks after the election was over. And he says this: "The lack of excitement and of active interest in the presidential campaign of 1892 is a feature common to both parties. For a period of more than 3 months after the nominations were made, the country gave no intimation of any special concern in the result. Possibly this may indicate that henceforth presidential elections will attract less absorbing attention than heretofore, and that as the people grow more numerous, they grow less partisan, and that all political elections seem to be less of a moment to a republic of 65 millions than it was to a republic of 20 millions." So he thought that maybe this is a sign that nobody really cares about who the damn president is, and the fabled elections of yesteryear are going to be no more.
So Blaine was not only the continental liar, he was also
He's so
not a
wrong.
great, he's not a very good prognosticator either.
Well, I mean, this is a point in which the presidency isn't particularly powerful,
That's right.
there were other jobs in Washington that would seem to have just as much power without as much baggage attached to it.
So just to make sure that our listeners are clear on this, so Cleveland had been elected in 1884.
Yes.
He lost to Harrison in 1888, and they're
Yes.
having their rematch in 1892.
Yes.
And people are not very interested and fed up with both of them. So this might be the one that, on the surface at least, seems the most like 2024.
Yes. And I should point out the campaign actually, like, everybody stopped campaigning 3 weeks before the election because Benjamin Harrison's wife did die. And so everyone basically, campaigning in the 19th century is not like campaigning today. It's much more of a low-key affair. But even then, they just basically stopped doing it. And so, I think this is a similar kind of situation that there are both candidates were pretty unpopular, or at least didn't have the kind of enthusiasm that they had hoped for. And I think the fact that a third party candidate got 22 electoral votes, I think sort of speaks to the sort of dissatisfaction with the major parties.
So Cleveland wins,
Yes.
and therefore is the only person ever to be elected president twice in non-contiguous terms.
Yes. Thus far.
Thus far. So
Yes.
what do we make of that?
Well, as soon as after he got his second term didn't go very well. There was an economic crash in 1893, and it was a disaster. So, Cleveland's an interesting figure because he's a Democrat, and there aren't that many. He's the only Democrat to be elected president between the end of the Civil or end of since Reconstruction through Woodrow Wilson. He has this very marginal political base. He's from New York, and basically his strategy, the Democratic strategy at the time, was to win the solid South and then win New York, the most populous state with the most electoral votes, and that's how you win. But it didn't pay off for him all the time.
Sorry, David, bit of trivia, and I think you probably know this, but do you know what the name of his second vice president was?
Adlai Stevenson.
Yes. And the reason I ask is because, of course, that name will crop up again. One of the things that's interesting about this topic is the number of family connections. So
Connections, yes.
everybody park that. So Adlai Stevenson was Grover Cleveland's vice president during his second term as president.
Yes. All right. The number of family connections in this is weird and it means nothing, but it's interesting.
Oh, well, is it, I think it might mean something, which is to sense, which is that it's a reminder that the dynastic element is quite important in American politics over a long period. The dynasties change, but there is a dynastic element that seems slightly incongruous in a democracy. And so we see this with the Trump family at the moment, but the Clintons before, the Bushes,
Mm.
in our contemporary politics, the Kennedys going a little bit further back. But it's not new, I
To be
guess.
sure.
Yeah, but so I don't think it's just trivial, but
No, I think it's intriguing though that they're all showing up in these kinds of world
yes.
elections.
Yeah, that's right.
But I think actually, the name recognition helped Benjamin Harrison because, his two qualifications was his grandfather was president and he was a mediocre Civil War general.
Right.
It's not like he had a whole lot going for him other than that. Our penultimate rematch is in 1900, McKinley versus William Jennings Bryan. This is the 4 years earlier. I bet they had a very contentious election over some very big issues in 1896, an election that was largely divided over the issue of free silver. Some of people may remember the William Jennings Bryan speech from 1896, the Cross of Gold speech, the way in which that was a divisive political issue then. And this rematch is kind of unexciting. McKinley rolls to the renomination pretty easily. There is some talk about potentially having Admiral George Dewey replace Bryan for about 15 seconds during the Democratic nomination process, but then Dewey says a number of dumb things, and so they go with Bryan again. This is an election in which the economy in the previous 4 years had been doing really well, so the free silver issue had largely died. The United States had been victorious in the war against Spain. And so that made McKinley look good. And so this is an election where the rematch, Bryan loses the first time and he loses even worse the second time. And so it's not a particularly exciting rematch in that respect. Anything else you want to add about 1900? I think that's the least interesting of the
Not,
ones
yeah, I
we're
think it is
talking
the
about.
least interesting. I mean, I think Bryan's a really interesting character because he runs for president, I think, four times. He runs in 1892 as a populist candidate. He'll run again, I think, in 1908. And he serves as Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, and he'll be the main lawyer during the Scopes Monkey trial. He has a very long and prominent career. He's a really important figure in that progressive era around it, generally standing for anti-progressive causes, it should be said. But he's a complicated and fascinating character, much more interesting in many respects than McKinley. But
No, to be
I don't think
sure.
there's much, I don't think there's much to say about that election.
Well, I mean, the most exciting thing for people who are watching the election is that McKinley's first vice president had died, and so he gets replaced by Teddy Roosevelt, who people were very excited about because he was the big war hero. But the economy was doing quite well, and if you're the president and the economy is doing well, that usually means you have a pretty good chance of re-election. I think one of the weird things about the situation at the moment in this current re-election process is we have a very strange scenario where the economy is doing well, but polling suggests people think the economy is not doing well. And so how do you rectify the real numbers versus what people think is going on
Yeah, I mean
is a conundrum.
this week's issue of The Economist has the cover story is about the strength of the U.S. economy, and it makes a very persuasive case for the high performance of the U.S. economy coming out of COVID. But as you say, there's a perception among wide swathes of the electorate that that's not the case, and so there's a real disconnect there. I think we need to caution people that there's still a long time between now and election day, and and I don't think people are necessarily paying that close attention yet. So that might be a factor, but we shall see.
Just to consider, at this point in, I guess, 1968, Lyndon Johnson was still running for re-election.
That's right.
You
That's
know,
right. So.
and we know how that turned out. Right. The last of these is in, and again, we'll see some echoes here, I think are interesting, is in 1956, a rematch of 1952, Dwight David Eisenhower versus Adlai Stevenson II, the son of the Adlai Stevenson that we saw,
Grandson.
grandson, sorry, you're right.
Grandson.
But he's the second, so he's
He
not a
is the
junior
second.
yet. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I think this is an election where there's some echoes like of today. Age was a big issue in this election. Eisenhower was not only old, he was not in great health. He had a heart attack. There was some talk that he might not even run for re-election. One of the, I think, advantages that Eisenhower had in this election is that television was a relatively new medium. But I think Eisenhower recognized that he could probably campaign in a new way that didn't require him to be on a train or a plane, all the time traveling around the country, that he could use television as a means of campaign tool. So I think that, the media issue, I think, shows up in several of these as being a running theme about how the media landscape changes. Adlai Stevenson faced several challenges for the renomination. There were several other Democrats who thought they deserved a chance to face Eisenhower. This is at a point, I think, in which primaries are starting to be important, but the campaign decisions are still really made still at the convention. So there had been some early primaries in which Estes Kefauver had won. In New Hampshire and Minnesota, but then Stevenson wins Florida and California, and Kefauver runs out of money. But most of the decisions are still being made at the convention. Stevenson's really interested in making the convention exciting, despite the fact it was a replay of the last convention. So, do you know what he does, Frank?
No, I don't.
No, he says, "Thank you for the nomination. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to let the convention decide who my running mate is." And he had not
That's
told
right.
anybody about this
Right.
beforehand. And so the people who are then decide, like, do I want to be vice president? Have like 12 hours to figure out whether they want to throw their hat in the ring for this. There is even a brief chance that John Kennedy was going to be his running mate. That was actually who Adlai Stevenson wanted to have as his running mate. But the convention picked Estes Kefauver, which obviously didn't work out. Adlai Stevenson, by the way, and John Kennedy went to the same high school.
Did they?
Yes,
Right.
not together, but because they're radically different ages. But they went to the same high school, so they good thing they
And
weren't
what
running
high
mates. But
school was that, David?
that was the Choate School of Wallingford, Connecticut, which is a very fine institution, because that's where I
David,
went
would you
to.
like to tell the listeners where you went to high
That
school?
that's where I went to high school. Yes. And where I met my lovely wife, where she also went to high school and all kinds of things. So I have warm feelings attached to it, not only because it's an alma mater, but as for other reasons. Right. But this is a landslide election for Eisenhower. He wins pretty easily. And so I think if we're doing sort of the overview of these six, we've got the incumbent winning twice in the most recent ones, but then the challenger winning in the other ones.
Yeah, can I say something about 1956
Sure.
before we try to sum up what all this might may or may not mean? 56 is interesting in another way. So you're right. Eisenhower's age and health was an issue. But Stevenson was portrayed, undoubtedly because he went to Choate,
That's it.
as a bit of an egg-headed nerd, right? And not really, he didn't have a common touch. And he was presented that way both in 52 and 56 to great effect, actually. The Republicans did that quite well. They basically said, he's a pointy-headed intellectual. We don't want that. Now, Eisenhower was a war hero. Eisenhower's name recognition was probably, unparalleled, actually, globally.
At Taylor Swift levels.
Yeah, Taylor Swift levels. That's right. And so I'm not sure Stevenson could have beaten him in any. Under any circumstances, but it is interesting that that was used against Stevenson. I don't think that's necessarily going to be a factor in 2024, but as a kind of anti-intellectualism as a political tool is an interesting has an a long and interesting history in the United States. So I think it's worth just noting that. As I said, I don't think that's necessarily germane in the current race. So what do we make of all this? What do we make of all this?
Well, so I mean, I think one thing in all of these cases that there tends to be a lot of mudslinging in all of these elections, or nearly all of these elections. And I think part of that is One of the things that happens during a normal election is you introduce at least one of the candidates to the voter, and you get to meet them and you get to learn about their history and you get to read their campaign memoir and you get to learn what their stances are on the issues. But when it's a rematch, you already know all that stuff.
Yep.
And so much comes much more about, or at least it often seems to be attacking them for their particular flaws, which are often very well documented. And I think that's the case in many of these prior rematches. And it's obviously going to be the case in this coming election where, at least what we've seen thus far, there have been some issues discussed, but there's been a lot more, I think, mudslinging than substantive debate about actual policy.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Obviously,
If we're gonna,
age is
sorry,
an issue, in several of these. So,
if we're going to approach this using the using the methodology of sabermetrics. So if we were, the baseball season's about to start. So we've had this happen six times before, and in four cases, the previous loser has won, including the most germane case in terms of the circumstances, Grover Cleveland winning in 1892. What does this tell us? On the other hand, if we have recency bias in the most recent cases, which are
Yes.
in 1900 and 1956, so they're not terribly recent, the incumbent has won. So what does that is the sample size too small to be relevant? Does the
I
time
think,
matter?
I think the sample size is too small to make any meaningful patterns out of six cases where it's four one way to the other. I do wonder if there's going to be, and as you point out, there's still a long time until election day, what the voter apathy about this election is going to mean. In some of these rematches, there's a lot of voter enthusiasm. We can think about 1828, where the Jackson supporters sort of came out in droves. But I'm betting this will be a lot more like 1892, where a lot of the voters are dislike both candidates enough where they either don't show up to vote, or if they show up to vote, they're showing up to vote for down ballot things, or if they show up to vote, they're voting in charge to vote against somebody much more than they are voting for somebody.
What does it mean, David, that this happened six times in 156 years and hasn't happened since?
That's a good question. I think one of the things that's different now or different in for most of the 20th century is you do have, especially in the second half of the 20th century, a robust primary system. And I think there's not a whole lot of an appetite for a losing candidate to run again in terms of getting support at the primary level, in terms of getting funds from donors. I think there's a sense that once you've lost an election, you're kind of damaged goods. I think we've seen some pretty decent politicians lose, run for president and then lose, and then are kind of retired after that in some way, at least from that presidential race.
Right.
I'm thinking here about like John Kerry loses an election. Al Gore loses an election, and they're sort of, even though they could run again, they don't. I think as long as you don't, if you run and don't get the nomination, it's fine to run again. But if you actually get the nomination and you lose, then I think people have said, look, we've bet on that horse, and that horse is lost, and we're not betting on the horse again.
Yeah, the last person to do that successfully was Nixon, who lost in 1960 and then, of course, won in 1968. But you're right. It's kind of paradox here. You can run and not get the nomination, and that means your political career is
Like
still
Joe
alive.
Biden, who ran for
Right.
president, a whole bunch of times.
Right. But if you win and get the nomination and don't succeed, at least in the past 60 years, that's it. You're done. And I suspect that will continue to be true. I suspect that will continue to be true. Obviously, I mean, 2028 is going to be interesting because we're going to have two new candidates.
Yes.
And 2028
Assuming the
really
Republic
will.
lasts that long.
Well, yes, 2028 will because it'll be the end of a long period of continuity, really. Because if you think about Obama's vice president, 2 terms, and then we will have had a lot of continuity, and we're going to have something new in 2028, which is well, something to consider.
We will see. But I mean, I think both parties are running as if this is an existential election, and that the future of the Republic rests on it, in a way that sometimes you find in elections, and other times, I don't think anybody looked at Eisenhower and Stevenson and said, "Oh, this is going to decide the fate of the Republic," or
No.
Benjamin Harrison versus Cleveland.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have time in the coming months and probably after the election to reflect on what it all means. So let's not anticipate that quite yet.
To be
I
sure.
actually think it might be helpful to dial down some of the rhetoric around
Well,
this.
I think it's helpful to dial down the rhetoric. I'm just pointing out that the campaigns are leaning into that kind of apocalyptic, if we don't win, then the country as we know it is over, whatever that means. I think we it's time for last drops, and I think I'll
Yeah,
go
David,
first.
what's your last drop? Go ahead.
Well, so I want to invite folks, if they're in Edinburgh and are so inclined, to my inaugural lecture, which is going to be on April 3rd at 5:15, and I'll put a link to the details in the show notes. But this is going to be sort of a weird inaugural lecture because it's also sort of my farewell lecture simultaneously. This will be hopefully not my Benjamin or my William Henry Harrison moment, where my hello and farewell are the same thing, but in some ways it is. Hopefully, I won't die immediately
So,
from.
David, sorry, David, tell us the title of your lecture,
Oh, sorry.
please.
The title of my lecture is Two Detectives Against the Klan, and there's a very long 19th century subtitle, which I have now forgotten and I will look up, which I gave for, what's the subtitle that I gave it?
I've got it. I've got
Oh,
it.
you've got it.
Or the American fight against white supremacy during Reconstruction and after.
After, yes.
And you're right, David. It is a 19th century style title.
I did that on purpose to evoke a certain mood of the Gilded Age
So
or
David,
something.
I will be unable to attend your inaugural lecture, but I am not pulling a John Adams. This is not a comment on
You're
you
not
or our relationship.
Oh, good. Well, I can talk
Well,
trash about you during the lecture then, and you won't be there to hear it.
will it be streamed?
Not to my knowledge, although I will look into that whether that's a possibility if people want or record it or something. I don't know. They
So
haven't told
let's
me.
be clear. This your inaugural lecture is on April 3rd
Yes.
at 5:15.
15. Yes.
Right.
And
Okay. Great.
on
Well,
campus, and
congratulations.
it'll be a good time. I'm going to tell some interesting stories and hopefully inspirational stories and maybe some funny stories. We'll see. And obviously some depressing stories because that's my want, but it'd be a good time.
So,
And
David,
there's a
were you?
reception afterwards, so if for no other reason, come because there'll be some food and drink, what have you.
David, will you give? Are you going to double dip? Are you going to give this as your inaugural lecture when you get to Florida?
They don't do inaugural lectures at most American universities that I'm aware of.
But you'll do some kind of public event, I'm guessing, right?
That remains to be seen. I have no idea. I'm showing up on August 16th, which is, I guess, my start date there. And they have not told me if I have to give any address to the masses. So, we'll
Certainly,
see.
I mean, I have worked at Edinburgh since 1997, and I cannot recall an inaugural lecture that was also a valedictory lecture, a sort of farewell lecture at the same time. So you are doing something unique in the history of Edinburgh University, as far as I know it, David.
The past 300 years of the history department, I don't know. There's a backlog of inaugural lectures because of the pandemic, and when I got promoted to professor, I was thinking, oh, odds are I'm not going to be able to give an inaugural lecture because they still have to get through these other very talented colleagues who have not had a chance to do one, but through various machinations, they said, no, we're going to bump you to the head of the queue since you're leaving, which seems not entirely fair to me, but that's what they asked me to do, and I'm happy to oblige. And I'm hoping that people enjoy the talk.
It's remarkably gracious on the behalf of our institution.
Well, I thought it was very nice, and I'm looking forward to doing it. I'm looking forward to finishing writing it. I'm 3/4 of the way through that, but we'll see. It should be a good time. Frank, what you got for the last round?
Well, I want to make sure. So, first of all, congratulations on your lecture, David. I'm really
Thank you.
pleased for you. I want to mention another lecture that's upcoming at Edinburgh. As listeners will know, the annual Fennell Lecture is the highest profile lecture we have in history every year. And this year's Fennell Lecture will be delivered on the 23rd of May at 5 p.m. And the lecturer will be Shireen Saikali, Professor Shireen Saikali from the University of California at Santa Barbara. And she will be lecturing. Her lecture title is The Matter of Time, Race, Catastrophe, and Palestine. Professor Saikali is a historian of Palestine. We invited her prior to the recent events in the Middle East, but it will be a it's a very timely
To be
opportunity
sure, yeah.
to hear from a historian of that part of the world, and we're very much looking forward to her lecture near the end of May. And we'll share. I'll remind you about, or we will remind you, listeners, about this in the coming weeks and share details. But I wanted to
Okay.
highlight that for people.
Are tickets available or yet, or is that to be seen?
They are. There's a link. There's an Eventbrite link. In fact, I
Okay,
registered for
I'll.
a ticket earlier too. So I'm not returning to Edinburgh until July 1st. Well, I'll arrive on July 1st. But I'll be home for a week in May because I'm attending that lecture. So I'll look forward to that and look forward to seeing
Oh,
you, David, in person.
yes.
Yes.
That'd be a good time. We'll have to record a live episode then. Great. Well,
Yeah.
until next week, Frank. Cheers.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.